The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Hello and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Show, and welcome to Austria. This is Richard Palmer standing in for your regular host, Mr. Stephen Flurry, and we're doing something a little bit different today. Our office is closed. It's the Day of Atonement, so we are pre-recording this show. And about a week and a half ago, for the Feast of Trumpets, I traveled over to visit some of our supporters in Austria. And just the way the flight worked out, flying out on a Sunday morning, flying back towards the end of the day after the Feast of Trumpets, I had a bit of time to visit some sites in Austria and in Germany, to get some footage, to put a bit of a show together for you. So it's a bit of an experiment today. You'll have to let us know what you think. I think I have some fascinating material I'm excited to share with you. Don't worry, this is not going to be me showing you my holiday snaps for an hour. I think I learned a lot on this trip. I saw quite a few things more clearly, learned a lot about history, a lot about the news. It brought some scriptures from the Bible to life. And hopefully some of this material will do the same for you. So we'll have some video of some of the things I'll be talking about. You can get the video stream on our website, thetrumpet.com. You can, of course, listen live with our broadcast partners over on CRN Digital Talk Radio on Channel 3 and then on several other channels as it's repeated on throughout the day. You can download the program as a podcast. And don't worry, you don't need the video. I'll be describing everything that's there, but it will... add to some of what I'm talking about if you do have that. And we're going to start with a visit right to the heart of Adolf Hitler's Third Reich. That is right here. And if you're watching the video, you'll see this does not look like the heart of much at all. Perhaps only the heart of a forest. Well, one of the places I visited during my trip was Berchtesgaden. And if people have heard of this at all, they tend to associate it with Hitler's eagle's nest, his mountain tea house high in the Alps. That's not this forest location. I did actually visit the eagle's nest, and you can see why people focus on it, why it draws about 500,000 or just under 500,000 tourists a year. It's an incredibly impressive location. You get up to it on a bus and then through a lift carved into solid rock. And, it really is beautiful. When I was up there, I got a bit distracted away from visiting Hitler's tea house, ended up going off hiking for an hour or two. You've got all kinds of incredible views. The day wasn't the clearest, but you could still see a long way into Austria, a long way into Germany. Didn't see any eagles while I was up there, incidentally, but we used to have the bird pictures that Mr. Flurry would show on this show periodically. I don't think we've seen any bird pictures for a while. So here's some alpine chow, a kind of crow or raven that lives in this area. But Hitler was very proud of his eagle's nest, but he didn't spend a mass amount of time there, unlike this forest location that we started with. This pretty nondescript location, there's not much going on here. It was actually the site of Hitler's Berghof, Hitler's mountain farmhouse, as he kind of tried to pass it off as. And this location here in what was the town of Obersalzberg is where he finished Mein Kampf. It's where he planned World War II and the Holocaust. He called Berchtesgaden his Wahlheimat, his homeland that he chose. During his time, he spent more time here in Obersalzberg than in any other place. In the book Your Complete Guide to Berchtesgaden by David Harper, he wrote, "It was here that Hitler's power matured, that the nationalist socialist ideology was elaborated, a place he used as a stage where he could show off to his visitors. And above all, it was at Obersalzberg that his plans for human suffering, mass genocide, and territorial takeover developed." So this place, it's in Germany. It does stick out into Austria. It's pretty close to Salzburg. It's got Hitler's original homeland pretty much clearly in view. There's some fascinating history here. It tells us some important things about the Third Reich, some very important things about Hitler's past, and very important things about the future of Europe. There is a powerful picture of a reality in Europe right here in Berchtesgaden. As is well known, Hitler tried to take over with his beer hall putsch in 1923. He was sent to jail. He was given a very light sentence. The judges kind of agreed with a lot of his ideology. And when he was released in 1924, he got rooms here in this town of Obersalzberg in Berchtesgaden. And he used this place to kind of remove himself from politics, to try and paint himself as just this simple hermit in the mountains, not seeking office. If people wanted to speak to him, you know, he wasn't living in Berlin, the center of power and the capital, or at least not always. He would make a lot of people come out to him in Obersalzberg. I think this is interesting in light of the fact that one man we've been watching who could be Germany's next strongman, he got caught up in scandal quite a few years ago. He has then stayed away from politics. He stayed away from Berlin in general. And he's been waiting for people to come and seek him out. It's a similar kind of policy to what Adolf Hitler did after he tried to take power the first time. And from 1924 onwards, he generally spent 2 to 6 months of the year here in Berchtesgaden. And he loved to, like I said, to try and get people to come out and see him as he tried to present himself as this simple mountain farmer. And he tried to come across as this humble man of the mountains, kind of friendly with children and animals. And he continued this even on into the Third Reich with all kinds of propaganda videos being shot of him in this area, surrounded by children. But he continued living in this area and spending a whole lot of time here once he came to power. Once the Nazis took over, this whole area became restricted. You can still see today the remains of guardhouses that were used to keep people out. You know, you had to be approved to come into this area. And all of the top Nazis had homes here. It was like a big holiday camp for Nazis where they could live in this incredible, beautiful surroundings and get together and have meetings and plot the murder, the mass murder of millions. But why did he choose this location? Why was this particular place so special to him? Well, now it's almost all gone. The houses are almost impossible to find. Hitler's Eagle's Nest, that's a big tourist draw. Hitler's Burghof, his main house, his place where he lived more than any other place, is very deliberately not a big tourist location. It's not on any of the tourist maps. It's not on any. It's not even on any of the signs, at least not officially. I've got a picture here where you can see somebody took matters into their own hands. But this is all done very deliberately. It was so closely related to Hitler and everything that he did that people feared it would become a place of pilgrimage for neo-Nazis after the war. So the building had already been damaged in an RAF bombing raid towards the end of the war. But then the US knocked the house down, the rest of the house down in the 1950s. And the German government planted a forest all around it. You can see we've got some pictures of how it used to look. But they deliberately blotted this out, tried to even get the landscape itself to help hide it. There's just about just this kind of rear retaining wall left. But there was basically a whole town of Nazis here, all wiped out. You know, this is a picture, for example, of where Martin Bormann had a house. He was the only one allowed a direct view of Hitler's house. This is where a barracks used to be. This, as best as I could tell, was the country retreat of Hermann Göring. I was kind of going by a book that had some descriptions and took you through on a walk of where these places used to be. Sometimes it was still hard to find them. In this particular one, you know, there was references to like, well, a bench and that kind of thing, and the bench was gone. So I'm not completely sure even that this was Göring's house, but it was the best I could do. They wiped it out. And you can understand why. They wanted to ensure that this didn't become, you know, a pilgrimage place, a place where Adolf Hitler fans would come to understand how he drew inspiration to plunge the world into World War II. You can understand why they did not want that to happen. Even so, there are still some Nazis that do come. You could see when I was there, I found a little bit of graffiti. Looks like it was left by neo-Nazis or pro-Nazis. The date on that graffiti is the day before I visited. So there are people that are coming and going. Now, there is a documentation center in Oberalsburg that covers all of this history. It was shut down when I was there, so I don't know how much they get into. It's shut down until 2023 for renovations and this kind of thing. There are a few buildings still remaining. There's the Hotel Zum Türken, for example. Türken, I guess it would be a hotel that had the misfortune of being next door to Adolf Hitler's house. So eventually its owner was sent off to Dachau, to the concentration camp, until he agreed to sell it at a knockdown price and died of a heart attack shortly afterwards. And the hotel became a kind of security headquarters. So this wasn't destroyed like a lot of the other buildings, because the family was given their hotel back after the war. And so it was not knocked down like everything else. But the Nazis gradually took over the whole area. Up to 6,000 workers were here, building these grand palatial homes for those that were right at the top of this growing European empire. And Hitler bought a bigger house and then built a bigger house. He turned his Berghof into something much more like a palace than the simple mountain home that he tried to pretend that it was, or the simple country farmhouse. And now, as I said, when you look around, you see nothing. It just looks like a forest. And here you can see the area. You've kind of got an aerial view looking down from the Eagle's Nest on the area of Obersalzberg. And you can see a couple of hotels and a few big buildings, but it's you know, there's no sign of a town or anything like that at all. But what if I were to tell you that something very real, very tangible, very concrete from Adolf Hitler still remains at Obersalzberg? You can't find it by looking at the surface. There is absolutely no sign of it from above. It is completely invisible, but still very real and very tangible. To find it, you have to look underground. The Nazis started digging under their houses. At first, it was air raid shelters or places to hide their stolen artworks. And then their plans got bigger and more grandiose, and they expanded. So by the end of the war, there were 4 miles of tunnels underground, connecting many of these different buildings together. Every entrance had a guard post to prevent paratroopers from breaking in. They had a system that would make all the core rooms unable to be poisoned by poison gas. It was resistant to poison gas. It had its own power in the form of diesel submarine engines and underground fuel tanks, enough food stored up to feed hundreds for 6 months. Some of these tunnels were so well hidden that they weren't discovered even to 50-plus years later. And there were absolutely massive future plans. They included plans for a 2-lane road going underground, connecting all of these different bunkers, a garage for cars, a fire station, exits so that Hitler could kind of retreat out of his house and have a secret exit from the mountain, one facing Austria, another facing Germany. Harper wrote in his book, "The entire system would have resulted in an underground safe haven of enormous dimensions. The engineer-in-chief of the bunker system was to design entrance doors that would have weighed some 400 tons each. They were to withstand any known explosion. It wasn't until after the war that it became clear to him that Hitler had been planning on turning Obersalzberg's underworld into a massive nuclear bomb shelter." So there's this massive underground fortress, almost, built under Obersalzberg. There were all these rumors towards the end of the war of a secret underground redoubt, an underground mountain fortress of the Nazis. And Obersalzberg didn't quite meet all of those rumors. And Hitler didn't complete all of his grandiose visions. But this is where a lot of those rumors came from, this bunker system that he built himself. And it did turn out to be effective. On April 25th, 1945, the Royal Air Force dropped 1,200 tons of bombs onto Obersalzberg. 3,500 people hid in the underground tunnels here, and not a single one was hurt. completely protected from the bombing up above. The only casualties were those that were too far away to reach the tunnels in time when they got warning of the attacks. So this whole area is just a powerful picture of this prophecy that we keep coming back to. One in Revelation chapter 17 and verse 8. It's one that we talk about quite a lot on this show and on the Trumpet Hour because it tells us so much about what is happening in Europe. I'm sure many of you understand it. But seeing Obersalzberg to me just gave me such a vivid image of this prophecy. It really starts to bring it to life and make it tangible. It helps burn this prophecy into your mind. So Revelation 17, of course, is this prophecy of a beast power rising and falling in Europe. It appears on the scene and then it disappears. It rises and falls a total of 7 times. And it's led by a king. And Adolf Hitler was the 6th king, the 6th leader of this Holy Roman Empire. And then in verse 8, it says, "The beast which you saw was and is not, and shall ascend out of the bottomless pit and go into perdition. And they that dwell upon the earth shall wonder, whose names are not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, when they behold the beast that was and is not and yet is." So here you see this grand fortress that represented so much of what Adolf Hitler did. It was here, for example, that he met with Mussolini, and he would have all of these world leaders. Here's just to give you an idea of what was here. Here's just a short video from a newsreel of Hitler meeting with Mussolini in his mountain home.
Besprechungen zwischen den beiden Regierungschefs waren getragen von dem Geiste der engen Freundschaft und unlösbaren Waffenbrüderschaft der beiden Völker und ihrer Führer. Sie ergaben die völlige Übereinstimmung der Auffassungen über die durch die überwältigenden Siege der Dreierpaktmächte geschaffenen Lage und über die weitere Kriegführung der beiden Nationen auf politischem und militärischem Gebiet. Die harte Entschlossenheit Deutschlands, Italiens und ihrer Verbündeten, den endgültigen Sieg mit allen ihnen zur Verfügung stehenden Machtmitteln sicherzustellen, kam dabei erneut zum Ausdruck.
So that's what was here. Now it's all forest. Now it's all gone, but there's still a lot underground. Mr. Armstrong talked about this a lot. Here's what Mr. Flurry had to say about this, just summarizing some of this prophecy in his book, Prophesy Again. And yet God says it is. The Axis powers lost the war, but Mr. Armstrong preached time and time again. They just went underground into the bottomless pit. They're still there. They're just underground. And that's what you see in Obersalzberg. This whole mountain complex that Hitler built, you look on the surface and it is not, it's gone. These places where he discussed battle plans with Mussolini, but it still is. The tunnels are there underground. Here's just one clip from a radio broadcast where Mr. Armstrong talked about this.
It's rising up. You don't see it. It's still underground. It hasn't emerged above ground yet. But we're going to stand aghast. The people of the world are going to be dumbfounded when this thing comes. All who don't know the Bible and the prophecies and know that it's coming, and you're going to see that come. 10 nations will form a United States of Europe. A resurrected Roman Empire. It's coming. And this is talking of the doom of that.
So Berchtesgaden gives you a dramatic picture of that. Now, I'm not saying that there are literally Nazis hiding in the tunnels right now or anything like that. I would have loved to go down and see the tunnels, actually. There's one set of tunnels you can get to at the Documentation Center, and then that's closed until 2023. There's another set that's closed due to COVID still. There's a lot of COVID restrictions still going on in Germany, so you couldn't go down there. But anyway, I don't think there are Nazis in these tunnels. But what a dramatic metaphor. When most people look at Germany, they see a peaceful forest. They look for the beast and they look around and they say, well, there's nothing there. Now, these days, there's more and more signs of this beast rising up. There's more signs that it is rising. And if you look, if you really look, you can see that. But certainly when Mr. Armstrong was alive and at the end of his life, people just saw this peaceful forest. And they said, look, there's nothing here. There is nothing to be afraid of. Nazism has been destroyed. Fascism in Italy has been destroyed. It's all gone. All these edifices of Nazism, they've been torn down. And that is true on the surface. Now, there was no Nazi party in Germany. Adolf Hitler was gone. And all the, say, the big obvious mansions and villas, they're gone. But we've not been through and destroyed thoroughly what is underground. You know, there are still these routes, there are still these tunnels buried deep into the mountains where, okay, they're sitting out the storm, they're sitting out the attack, they're sitting out this this time of, say, persecution for at least for the Holy Roman Empire, or this time where it's not doing so well. But there are, the spirit of Nazism is there. It's just underground. How thorough are we? Did we completely dig out that spirit of Nazism? You know, you get a real picture of that in Obersalzberg. The Royal Air Force comes along, does a huge amount of damage on the surface, but all the people, all the main infrastructure survive and then come back out of those tunnels. And this is what Revelation 17, verses 8 to 10 tells us. Don't look at the surface. Don't trust what you see on the surface. A lot of people, they still look on the surface. And like I said, there are indications now of this Holy Roman Empire rising right back up. But the Bible says, don't look on the surface. It's going to come back from the underground. And as Mr. Armstrong emphasized, it's going to catch the world by surprise because they've just been looking at this forest on the surface. I mean, today we've got more and more, say, bits of graffiti and things, you know, evidence in politics that something's coming back up. But there's a lot of people that still look on the surface and say, you know, we're fine. It's all good. Nothing to worry about. But the Bible says you need to look in the bottomless pit. You need to look underground, and it's going to come right back up from that underground. And this, you know, you see this in Italy. This is part of the reason why so many are completely unconcerned by the rise of a party that is directly connected to the fascist party in World War II, that is a direct descendant of Mussolini's party. It's just kind of gone through a couple of renames, but it's, you know, it's the same party that Mussolini founded. People look at that and say, well, look, it was all destroyed. All of those buildings were torn down. There is nothing to worry about. And so they don't worry about Giorgio Meloni rising in Italy. You know, there's a lot of people, even in the right, who are so correct about so many things, looking at Mussolini and says, no, she's an ally in our fight against the radical left. It's a good thing that she's here. But we need to be concerned about, the Bible says we need to be concerned about this beast power rising back up from the underground. Don't look at what's on the surface. Don't look at what's on the surface. Look at the underground. And you can look and you can find so many sources now. So many sources that said that, well, Nazis were never really dug out of power. The most high-profile ones were punished, but no one else really was. That so many of the same officials that were in charge of, or that were running most of these different German ministries and departments during World War II, they just kept right on going after World War II. You can ask any historian you like, and they will tell you that so many of these Nazis were allowed to keep going, that just about every government department was thoroughly infiltrated by Nazis. The Bible said this would happen. It said they would be underground, go underground. But nobody sees this as a danger. They're not looking at that underground as a danger at all. There's another prophecy in the book of Nahum that talks about these German generals and these Nazis being being like grasshoppers, and it, you know, it goes through some of the weather and things like that, but it talks about it being like a hedge, that one moment it's full of grasshoppers, and then you look around and they're all gone. And it's like that in Obersalzberg. It was just absolutely full of top Nazis, and now you look there and it's all forests. But the underground remains. But there's more powerful lessons we can learn about this underground from Obersalzberg, from Hitler's Berghof. And we would be more worried, more concerned about all these news stories about Nazis going underground if we understood what happened in the past, if we understood the deep connection, you know, if we understood why Hitler chose this location for his Berghof. There's a powerful warning in his choice of that location. And we'll talk about that right after this break.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
Herbert W. Armstrong described Germany's devastating destruction in 1944 and 1945 as one of the worst beatings ever administered to any nation. Western leaders from both sides of the Atlantic assured our peoples that a demoralized Germany would never again be able to disturb the peace of the world. But while Washington and London were promising that German militarism would never again be able to strike, Herbert Armstrong was warning the world of one final resurrection of a German-led Holy Roman Empire. Only a very few listened. Mr. Armstrong said German industry and the German people's willpower and determination to work, produce, and organize was the very heart and lifeblood of all Europe.
The nations of Europe want to unite. They just don't know how to do it.
He said the prostrate body of Europe could not come back without the leadership of a revived and vigorous Germany.
And the economic and the military body that is to rise up and to restore the Roman Empire, the thing that we least suspect here in the United States, it cannot rise up without its heart. And its heart is in Germany.
The world is witnessing history repeat itself one more time. Request Germany and the Holy Roman Empire for more on this important subject.
The Trumpet Daily.
Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily show. We're talking about Ober-Salzburg, the location where Hitler lived more than any other location in his life, where he planned a lot of World War II and the Holocaust. But why did he plan this location? Well, if you think back to the video that we watched of him and Mussolini and the interior of this Berghof, you'll remember he had an absolutely massive window. He put a lot of effort into this window. There were even hydraulic systems to lower it. And it was positioned very deliberately. His whole house, his whole Berghof was built up to give a view of one particular mountain. He chose his palace so that he would view this mountain. He built it. It all revolved around this mountain that he was obsessed with. This mountain is called Untersberg. Today, it's probably best known from being the mountain from The Sound of Music. It's where Julie Andrews sings, "The hills are alive with the sound of music," right at the start. It's where everyone is shown escaping at the end. But Hitler had a fascination with Untersberg for a very different reason. There are all kinds of myths that surround this mountain, stories of dwarfs and wild mountain women, but there was one in particular that really appealed to Hitler. I also had a chance to go up this mountain. There's a cable car that runs up there, so I went up there. This is the magnificent view from the top of Untersberg. Now it's that view's something else. There was even there's one of these places where they have all these different pictures of what you can see from on top, and it ended up just basically taunting me of what the fantastic view would have been had it been a clear day. But this was the mountain that Hitler was obsessed with because of some of these myths. And the one that really appealed to him was about a Holy Roman Emperor said to be asleep into this mountain. Some stories say it's Frederick the Great, others say it's Charlemagne. Hitler really latched on to Charlemagne. And the legend says that Charlemagne is asleep under this mountain, that he periodically wakes up, that he sends some of his knights or squires to go and to look outside and to look at the ravens, or really it's these alpine chow, these same birds that we mentioned briefly in the first half. And if these birds give the correct sign, he's going to wake up and leave the mountain and save Germany and battle the Antichrist. There's lots of different versions of this legend. I think you can really see in it a corruption of this same Bible prophecy that we're talking about, of this empire that goes dormant, that goes underground, and then that reawakens. The Holy Roman Empire really does sleep underground, and it does awaken periodically. But Hitler was really obsessed with this legend about Charlemagne sleeping under the mountain and that he would ride forth to save Germany. And it's yet another demonstration of the way that Hitler really connected himself with what went before. He didn't see his empire as kind of a unique, isolated phenomenon, but a resurrection of the same Holy Roman Empire that kept coming before. Now, Charlemagne led the First Reich. He led the Third Reich. He didn't call it a brand new Reich or the First Reich. It was a continuation of this Holy Roman Empire. He saw a direct line from himself to Charlemagne, and so he chose a house looking at what is supposedly Charlemagne's final resting place. Mr. Flurry wrote this in his article, "The Holy Roman Empire Goes Public Big Time." Many Europeans practically worship Charlemagne. Napoleon walked in his footsteps. Adolf Hitler looked to him as a hero. He called his own rule the Third Reich. Hitler started World War II, which led to the death of 60 million people. And Hitler brought the crown jewels of the Holy Roman Empire, the so-called Crown of Charlemagne, to Germany. John Toland wrote, Hitler had brought from Vienna after 140 years the insignia of the First Reich, the imperial crown, the orb of empire, the scepter, and the imperial sword. At the presentation of these symbols of imperialism, he solemnly vowed they would remain in Nuremberg forever. So he brought them to Germany, and Mr. Flory's often pointed back to Hitler's love and even obsession with those crown jewels and how much time he spent, even in Austria, when he was younger, staring at those crown jewels. You know, this shows there's something more here than one man. There's a system that keeps coming back up, motivated by the devil. But you see the same obsession in Hitler's home choice. You know, he would stare at that mountain, Untersberg, through a telescope. He had a special telescope for watching it. A massive picture window built to view it. He was obsessed with Charlemagne, and he was obsessed over this mountain in the same way he obsessed over those crown jewels. He devoured all the myths and legends about that mountain and strange tales about tourists wandering off and getting lost and then showing up months later wearing the same clothes. He may have even thought that these prophecies of a return of Charlemagne to come and set up a new empire and save Germany, he may have thought that they referred to him. So he worked to connect himself with Charlemagne in so many ways, and he even copied and based his prophecy or some of his policies off Charlemagne. He worked to have the same relationship with the Catholic Church that Charlemagne had. Was he looking back at Charlemagne and taking notes and saying, well, look, he conquered Europe after doing deals with the Catholic Church. Mussolini's done a deal with the Catholic Church. I'm going to do a deal with the Catholic Church and derive a lot of power from that. This really was the way that he thought. And so it should ring some alarm bells when we see modern politicians looking back to the same legacy of the Roman Empire and of Charlemagne. There's been a lot of commentary over the years about how this new right-wing movement in Italy, with both Giorgia Meloni, Matteo Salvini, they go back to the Roman Empire, the same Roman Empire that Charlemagne claimed to be reviving. And they point back to this Roman Empire. You see across the European Union, leaders pointing back to Charlemagne. Mr. Flory talked about that in that article. The Holy Roman Empire goes public big time. And he pointed back just how many of these modern European leaders are drawing on that legacy of the Holy Roman Empire. One of the EU's founding fathers, really, Otto von Habsburg, he said, we possess a European symbol. He's talking about the crown of Charlemagne. We possess a European symbol which belongs to all nations of Europe equally. This is the crown of the Holy Roman Empire, which embodies the tradition of Charlemagne. See, these leaders all say, well, we're following in Charlemagne's footsteps. The same thing that Adolf Hitler said. And Mr. Flory in that article quotes from the Encyclopedia Britannica, just talking about how bloody Charlemagne was, how many people he killed. The Holy Roman Empire killed an estimated 40 million people across the Middle Ages. Mr. Flory writes, that is history we need to know. And if we really knew this history, we would be deeply alarmed by the fact that Kurtz and a growing number of Europeans wanted to resurrect this history. He says, remarkably, as they were reviving it, Europeans are doing something they have never done since the vile and murderous Sixth Head. They are publicizing the Holy Roman Empire. So I can understand why they blotted out Obersalzberg, why they destroyed Hitler's Berghof and just wiped it out. And to a certain extent, I agree with that and sympathize with that. But if more people knew and understood about why this was Hitler's hometown of choice, that he was obsessed with this mountain where there's all these strange myths about Charlemagne sleeping, that he was obsessed with the crown jewels of Charlemagne and the crown of the Holy Roman Empire, and that he spent time just staring at this mountain through his telescope and staring at these crown jewels when he was in Vienna. Now, if we knew more about that history, we would be more concerned when leaders started talking about the legacy of Charlemagne and reviving Charlemagne. Because we'd know about all these other leaders that also claim to be reviving the legacy of Charlemagne. You know, yes, there's all this art and all this culture, and we're going to talk about that in just a second. But there's also this bloody history that we cannot ignore. Now, there's another lesson from this area, from this trip, from the Obersalzberg area, that reveals one of these deepest roots, one of these deepest tunnels that allows this beast power to rise up again and again. One of this, say, strongest redoubts that keeps enabling it to come up and rise again. And that is this beast power's relationship with the Catholic Church. Revelation chapter 17 talks about the Holy Roman Empire, and it said it's led by a church, a woman in Bible prophecy. And this church keeps helping to bring this beast back up from the underground. And like I said, those roots in Europe, they're deep and they're still there, especially these roots from the Catholic Church. As long as they're left in place, they're just going to help bring this Holy Roman Empire right back up. And this trip also just helped me really appreciate how deep these roots are. And in addition to visiting Berchtesgaden, I also visited Salzburg in Austria. And here you really can see how deeply rooted the Catholic Church is in Europe. We wrote about this in the Holy Roman Empire and Prophecy booklet. That's a booklet I helped do some research for. So I kind of knew academically, you know, it wasn't a surprise in some ways, but just to really see it illustrated really demonstrated to me just how strong these Catholic roots are within Europe, how deep they are into the foundations, why it is that the Catholic Church is so influential and able to keep bringing this empire right back up. In the Holy Roman Empire booklet, we wrote, no institution, government, or religion has shaped European history, which comprises a significant chunk of Western civilization, more than the Roman Catholic Church. In that book, we quoted historian Thomas Woods, who wrote, Western civilization owes far more to the Catholic Church than most people, Catholics included, often realize. The booklet goes on to talk about that Catholic leadership and teaching has a decisive and far-reaching influence on Western religion, politics, culture, science, and education, often in ways most people fail to recognize. The Vatican has presided over the rise and fall of kings and governments, the emergence of political and ideological movements, the discovery and colonization of new lands and people. The Catholic religion has influenced every facet of Western society, from art and music to science and the measurement of time to the annual holy days we celebrate. Its influence over Europe is even more extensive. It has shaped Europe's legal systems, its educational institutions, many of its most prominent cities, its economies, and even agriculture. You know, I mentioned cities there. You really see this visiting Salzburg. Salzburg Cathedral is one of the biggest structures that absolutely just dominates the town. It's a big, impressive cathedral. There's been a cathedral there for over 1,000 years. It has deep roots. You know, it's a beautiful and dominant building. It's not the most dominant building, though, in Salzburg. There is one building that literally towers over everything else, and that is the Hohensalzburg Fortress. It's built on the Festungsberg. It's high above the city. You know, you can see it from all over town. You've got these big views of the fortress. In fact, you can see Salzburg from Hitlerstown, from Obersalzberg in Berchtesgaden. And it's the Hohensalzburg Fortress that really stands out when you look at that town from a distance. And so who built this big fortress? What great king or prince or lord built this castle? Well, that was the archbishops of Salzburg too. That was the Catholic Church as well. They didn't just build the church or the cathedral, they built the castle. Because Salzburg was its own principality ruled by an archbishop who was both the religious and secular government of the town. He was called the Prince Archbishop. And just like in so many places in Europe after the Roman Empire fell, was the Catholic Church did the most to revive this Roman Empire, to hang on to art and learning from this empire. And they ended up with a huge amount of power, shaping the way that Europe developed after the fall of Rome. And you, like I said, you graphically see this demonstrated in Salzburg, where it was archbishops founding these different locations, building even these castles, running the city, running the area around it. And you look at that town and you see them right at the heart of Western civilization. And this is not close to the end of their major presence in Salzburg. You know, probably the next most impressive building in Salzburg itself is the Mirabell Palace, or the Schloss Mirabell. It's this 17th century ornate palace with really beautiful gardens. I barely scratched the surface when I was there, but it's considered home of one of the most beautiful wedding halls in the world. It's used in film sets, including The Sound of Music. And who built it? Yep, it was the Prince Archbishop. This time it was one of the Prince Archbishops built it for his mistress, who was Protestant. So they had, I think they had about 15 children. So yeah, interesting relationship, I guess. But it all stems from these Catholic leaders. The Holy Roman Empire booklet said, "The Roman Catholic Church is the most defining and influential institution in Europe's history, yet somehow it remains a total mystery." Visiting Salzburg really drove that home to me, that it's the most defining and influential institution in Europe's history. You just see it in the landscape of the city and what man has built. In the last few decades, the Catholic Church's influence may have waned a certain extent. And it takes a lot more than just a couple of a few decades of maybe being less religious to root that out. There's a huge amount of power there and heritage there. You know, Salzburg is this massive city of art and culture. You know, Mozart was born here and grew up here. They make a lot of that in this city. And he was employed early on by the Prince Archbishop, albeit reluctantly. And there's another warning here, another lesson from this area here. You know, you see someone like Italy's incoming leader, Giorgia Meloni, drawing close to the Catholic Church. And a lot of people think, well, great. Well, we need more religion. We need more God. We need more morality in our politics. And you can understand why they say that when you look at just the destructiveness of the radical secularism we see in America and Britain and all the homosexual agenda and how it's destroying families and destroying nations. But there's a warning from history here, too. You know, of the relationship that the role that the Catholic Church has had time and time again in reviving the Holy Roman Empire and then what it's gone on to do with that power. Yes, sponsor a lot of art and culture, but there's a lot of destruction as well. Like I said, a lot of art. You've got all of these museums from Mozart now, and you can go and see those. But there's a darker side to Salzburg and this rule by the Holy Roman Empire that's less obvious when you visit the town. Just 20 years before Mozart was born, the Prince Archbishops expelled all of the Protestants from Salzburg. An estimated one-fifth of the population, 20,000 to 30,000 people, just kicked out. And this was the latest in several expulsions. There were some that were pretty terrible. Of course, you go back to the 1500s and the 1600s, and these kind of things were going on all over Europe, where Protestant rulers were kicking out Catholics and Catholic rulers were kicking out Protestants. But those were a little different in the 1500s, 1600s. A lot of those, they had several years. You know, they'd kind of mutually agree. They'd have 3 years to sell their property and to wind down so that it would be easier to leave. But some of these that were coming from Salzburg in the 17th century and then even on into the 18th century were very different. You know, their one in the 17th century in Salzburg, they were going to kick out the parents, but keep the children. So the parents would have to go, but the children would then be educated and raised as Catholics, forcibly removed from their parents. And a lot of the Protestant powers in Europe, they were in an uproar about this, so the plans got changed a bit, but it was still very hard for parents to take their children with them, and the vast majority of children ended up staying. You know, stealing these children from their parents and then bringing them up as Catholics. And then you get to this expulsion in 1731. And during the so-called, now we're starting to get into the so-called Age of Enlightenment. You know, we're beyond the Middle Ages. We're beyond where you had a lot of these wars of religion, like the the 30-Year War. We're beyond that. But still, there's this religious persecution. 1731, they were given initially 8 days to all these Protestants to up and leave and get out of here. And this, you know, there was a massive outcry from abroad. It was extended to a few months. But still, this was 20,000 to 30,000 Protestants kicked out. And the government grabbed a chunk of their wealth on the way out. They were able to sell their property, but often only at a quarter, maybe a half if they were lucky, of what their property's value was. And that's the power that these prince archbishops had. We don't want one-fifth of our population, so they got to go. And we'll grab your wealth on the way out. And, I mean, they probably hurt themselves doing this, but there's a level of hatred there. And reading about this at the Salzburg Museum, and well, to their credit, at the Salzburg Museum, they have a room about this Protestant expulsion. But reading about that, a passage from the Daniel and Locke's Revelation booklet came to mind. And this is what Mr. Flurry wrote there. He said, "About the only thing Americans can seem to think about when it comes to Europe is somebody yodeling in the Alps. They have no idea what the Holy Roman Empire is about or what that crown, you know, the crown of Charlemagne, is about. They don't know about this deadly beast. You can travel all over Central Europe and see some of the opulence of the Habsburgs. The Habsburgs were the sword of the Catholic Church. Throughout the Middle Ages, they did their killing while supporting artists like Mozart, Bach, and Schubert. They were very sophisticated as they slaughtered people. And he talked about, well, you can travel around Europe, you can see those Habsburg castles. Many of them have dungeons below them. A tour guide will tell you the Habsburgs would be having great feasts upstairs listening to the finest classical music while people were being tortured to death below. Now, we can't be lulled to sleep by this great art and culture. The Bible says that you're going to have this same Catholic Church help the beast rise up again, and it's going to be there again. And if we were more familiar with this history, we'd be more worried about things like Giorgio Meloni talking about Europe's Christian heritage, reviving that history of the Roman Empire. But there's one kind of final couple of lessons I want to share with you that I took away from the trip that ultimately I think are incredibly positive, that are very relevant to this day that this message is going out on, the Day of Atonement. Now, this is a day that reminds us that this world is cut off from God, that our sins separate us from God. It's a day that shows us how we can be made at one with God. And there's a strong reminder on this day about how much we need to be made at one with God, that this world is not at one with God right now, that this world ultimately is in captivity to Satan the devil. There's a lot of Christians even today that don't want to talk about Satan the devil, but the Bible does from start to finish. And so there's a strong reminder on this day about how much we need to be made at one with God and how far we are from him at the moment. And Mr. Flurry writes about this in the Jeremiah booklet. We'll read that in just a second, but first we can go over to Jeremiah 17 and verse 9. Just here, Jeremiah gives us a vivid picture of what we are like without God, what human nature is like. Jeremiah 17 and verse 9 that says that the heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. Who can know it? You know, we have a mind and a human nature shaped by Satan the devil. It's ultimately Satan's nature. And Mr. Flurry writes, trusting in such minds destroys God's own church and nations. And yet that mind is the foundation of this world's education. Trusting sick human minds is why we live in such a sick, sick world. And he talked about how man kind of looks on, or education looks on man as being basically good and trustworthy. And he said that philosophy destroys institutions and nations. We must see the evil in human nature or we can never solve our problems. That is where man's false hope lies, in an incredibly deceitful mind that is terminally ill. Here is where men generally place their trust. What deadly deceit. Jeremiah 17 teaches the fundamental lesson about our human minds. If we truly understand, we won't let a day pass without intense Bible study and repentant prayer to our God. Only he can save us from our incurably sick minds. We are deathly ill and need a physician. So this Day of Atonement, reminds us we're cut off from God. It shows God's plan to bring mankind back at one, or bring mankind to be at one with him. And throughout this day, there are things that picture that we cannot trust our human minds. In the Old Testament ceremonies for this day, God had ancient Israel pick out two goats, one to represent Christ, another to represent the devil. And they had to cast lots to decide which is which. They had to have this solemn appeal to God and this religious ceremony for God to show them which goat represents God and which goat represents the devil. Man could not work it out on his own. They had to appeal to God to show them. We have to be looking to him, not to our own human minds. And you see this in some of the history we've covered as well. Man's mind is deeply flawed. And so often modern scholars think, well, we appreciate art and culture and beauty, so man must be good. Well, Hitler appreciated art and culture and beauty. Going back to David Harper's book on Berchtesgaden, you know, we see there that Hitler appreciated art and beauty. He writes, in 1942, Hitler confided to his cronies that all his greatest plans came into being at the Berghof, you know, this beautiful mountain retreat, and that he would receive his inspiration on its outdoor terraces under the starry skies. It was this in this idyllic setting, for instance, that his racial hate propaganda was developed, as well as his territorial megalomania. You know, it's surreal visiting there. You've got all these beautiful surroundings, and this is where Hitler invited Neville Chamberlain in 1938 to deceive him into giving up Czechoslovakia. This is where the chief architects of the Holocaust met. This is where Hitler was sending telegrams doing his deal with Stalin to divide up Eastern Europe between the two of them and start World War II. It's where he gave the order to stab Joseph Stalin in the back and take over Russia. And we can't let ourselves believe that because we're sophisticated and appreciate art and science and beauty that, well, we can trust our human minds. There's a lot of good there. And there's a sobering practical lesson from this Day of Atonement. But there is also a very positive, hope-filled lesson. And visiting Salzburg and Obersalzburg and, you know, the Hitler's Berghof, it really drove this lesson home powerfully as well. And what is really behind the Holy Roman Empire? What motivates it to rise and rise again? What is its deepest root? Well, ultimately, it's Satan the devil. You know, here's what we wrote about this in our Holy Roman Empire booklet. In our Holy Roman Empire booklet, it says, "The beast is Satan's creation. It is his primary instrument for deceiving mankind and seeking to destroy the followers of the true God." And this Day of Atonement, it pictures the total defeat of Satan, the total defeat of his Holy Roman Empire. You know, Satan's never going to be there, and this Holy Roman Empire will never rise again. Those roots will be thoroughly destroyed. And so when walking around Hitler's Berghof, there were another set of scriptures that came to mind about how this whole evil system is going to be completely, totally destroyed. In Isaiah 13, verses 19 to 22, it says, "And Babylon, the glory of kingdoms, the beauty of the Chaldees' excellency, shall be as when God overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah. It shall never be inhabited, neither shall it be dwelt in from generation to generation. Neither shall the Arabian pitch their tent there, nor the shepherds make their fold there, but the wild beasts of the desert shall lie there." It goes on, but you know, you can walk around Hitler's mountain palace, and there's nobody there. Once you get there, there is a sign telling you what was there, but there's nothing really much else pointing you there. It's not big. There's no these big crowd. There aren't any big crowds of tourists. It's almost like a prophecy of what's going to happen to the Holy Roman Empire as a whole. That, you know, this is where he developed all of these grandiose plans and built his palace, and it's an empty forest now. It's blotted out. And like I said, there's a lot wrong, I think, with blotting out of history. And there's still a lot that we need to learn from this history more deeply. But there also seems something appropriate about seeing Hitler's command center and this whole village of Nazis and this kind of pleasure place and pleasure palace of the Nazis gone. Now, it's almost like a prophecy of what will happen to this Holy Roman Empire. It's going to be wiped out. I thought it was just kind of interesting. Revelation 18 and verse 2 says, "And he cried mightily with a strong voice, saying, Babylon the Great is fallen, and become the habitation of devils and the hold of every foul spirit and a cage of every clean and every unclean and hateful bird." You know, this is what's going to happen to this modern Babylon empire in Europe. It's going to fall. It's going to be wiped out. It will become the cage of every unclean and hateful bird. And you go to Obersalzburg today and Hermann Göring's house and some of the buildings around where his house was. It's now a wild animal park, like a small kind of very small zoo where they keep birds of prey in cages. It's the cage of unclean birds even today. But Isaiah chapter 14 and verse 14 to 16 talks about Lucifer, Satan himself, this being that has motivated so much of this evil and destruction and murder. And it talks about him saying in verse 14, "I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will be like the Most High. Yet you shall be brought down to hell, to the sides of the pit. And they that see you shall narrowly look upon you and consider you, saying, Is this the man that made the earth tremble? Or is this the one that made the earth to tremble, that did shake kingdoms?" And this came through my mind walking around Obersalzburg. Is this the place that made the earth to tremble? Is this where Adolf Hitler shook kingdoms? And it's all just blotted out. And someday those tunnels will be blotted out too. Every work of the devil gone and destroyed. You know, Satan ultimately causes so much suffering. But on this Day of Atonement, God says he's going to end it forever. Satan will be put away. You know, there's a time at the end of the millennium. He'll be loose for a little season. But ultimately, Satan will be put away. Mankind will be freed from slavery to him. There will be no more evil empires rising ever again. And mankind will go on to an increasingly exciting and wonderful future. Well, that is about all we've got time for. If you want to know more about this beast power in Europe and what I've talked about along those lines today, please do read our booklet, The Holy Roman Empire in Prophecy. If you want to know more about the Day of Atonement, you know, I referenced a few events. I didn't necessarily have time to turn to a huge number of scriptures, but we have our free booklet, Pagan Holidays or God's Holy Days, which You can get both of those books on our website, thetrumpet.com. We'd be more than happy to send them to you. You can read them online. If you don't have the internet, we have a free phone number. You can call us 1-866-930-3024. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. If you have any questions or comments, you can get in touch, td@thetrumpet.com. Any feedback for us, we're very happy to hear from you. And we'll be right back, same time, same place tomorrow.